emphasize the main point. The point was, you take a phenomenon, a very general phenomenon, which you assume people will not deny that it takes place, and you show that it needs a cause, and that cause has to be what the Rambam calls a uncaused cause. In other words, a cause that's not an effect, a cause that doesn't require its own cause. And that is what we call God. All the Rambam showed was that the motion in the world has a first cause. And that we call God. Everything else you want to say about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you have to add for some other reason. What I tried to show, mostly by showing how it's answered. The answer, the Kantian answer is that once you do the Rav Chastai Kreskas Tikkun, they were asking what's the cause of the entire chain of causation, or the entire chain of motion, is that maybe the entire chain doesn't need a cause at all. And I use that to divide the world, to divide thinking people into two classes, naturalists and supernaturalists. Now, we've been trained that the word supernatural is a negative word. I'm a supernaturalist. I try to show why people believe in God are supernaturalists. Naturalism is the belief that nature explains itself. Everything in nature is explained by the system, and the system doesn't need an explanation. In other words, using the terms that the Rambam would use, the system is God. Which is why pantheism is a form of theism, but it's also, all atheists have to be pantheists. You have to somehow explain, either the system explains itself, or there's an explanation for the system, which we call God. Okay? Now today, I want to give you another version of the family, a very different version of the family of the cosmological proof. That's not just because I'm interested in the proof itself. It's a very important proof. It frankly is the most important proof, not the most persuasive, close to being the most persuasive, but definitely the most important, but mostly because it demonstrates very dramatically why the cosmological proof is important. And for that, before we start, I just want to go over the main point. The main point was that we said the cosmological proof tries to identify something which is a uncaused cause. In other words, its relationship to the world is that it's a cause of something or some things in the world, but is not itself caused by the world or anything else. Okay? That's different than had I shown, which may be attractive to some of you, that there exists something which is neither a cause nor a cause, nor an effect of the world. But that wouldn't be interesting, because then we couldn't possibly know anything about it. The reason why the proof works is because identify something which we can identify, motion or something, or change or something which is caused ultimately, which couldn't exist, it wouldn't take place were there not a God, were there not an uncaused cause. If there exists something whose relationship to the world is that it neither causes things in the world nor is caused by the world, we couldn't possibly get to it. So that might be more supernatural. It would be completely outside the system, but it wouldn't interest us. Occasionally, I don't know, in science fiction versions of comic books, as well as very, very advanced physics, neither one of which I read, but one of which I once read, you will come across the idea of parallel universes. And it's not interesting unless, by some hook or crook, somebody in the comic book has managed to move from one universe to the other. But if there are really parallel universes, then it's merely something which is in advanced physics. It fills in an equation somewhere, but it's not interesting because it has no effect on our universe. So the point that the cosmological proof shows is that God is a cause of things in the world. It could be just one thing. That's all the Rambam really proved. Motion. But it's not caused. But that's a very, very powerful idea, because if we then base everything we want to say about HaKadosh Baruch Hu on that, then the basic level is that we are dependent on God, and God is not dependent on us. It's sufficiently important. That's what the Rambam writes in Perek Aleph, Halacha Aleph of the Yad HaChazakah. He says he doesn't go over the proof. He says there's a first cause, and he then exemplifies what I mean by that. I mean that if the world didn't exist, God would still exist. But if God didn't exist, the world wouldn't exist. The dependency is one-sided. Okay, I'm now going to illustrate a particular version of that, which I think is very, very important. Today, in pop religious culture, dependency isn't stressed. I suspect it's because people don't like being dependent. In other words, if you try to sell God to religious people, to non-religious people, that you don't want to give them things which will make them feel uncomfortable. Being dependent on God in a one-sided manner, it will apply eventually when you develop your religious philosophy. It will apply obligation. It will apply even perhaps obedience. It will apply all kinds of things which are very important, but may not be comfortable. What people like to hear about today is friendship. And friendship is a two-sided relationship. I'm important to you, you're important to me. What the Rambam said, and I'm not saying it's the whole truth, but it's the first step, is that you're not important to God. God doesn't change. God is not caused. It's not affected. Nothing in God is affected by what takes place here, by you. We say it in the end of Tefillat Ne'ilah. Nothing we do really makes a difference to God, because what difference does it make to Him? But anything that God does or says will have an immediate effect here. Okay, I want to give a particular proof now. It's an important proof in its own, but mostly because I want to illustrate this very important point. If we start with the cosmological proof, then we are creating an unequal relationship between the world and God. Okay, the proof that I'm going to describe today is known as the ethical proof for the existence of God. This was the only proof that Kant accepted. He accepted because he thought it wasn't a real proof, but I mean, he knew what its flaw was. I'll describe the flaw as well. But nonetheless, he thought it was true, and it was his own personal proof of God. How does the ethical proof of the existence of God go? So first of all, what I'm not going to say. I'm not going to say, which maybe you heard in first grade, is that if there can't be ethics without God, because someone has to make it up. God has to decree the ethics, or else there wouldn't be ethics. I'll talk about that in the future. Mitzvah Hashem, right after Sukkot, why I think that's not true, why I think it's a terrible thing to say, even though you probably all heard it someplace at some time in school. And it's convenient to say that to atheists. Tell them, well, how can you be ethical if you don't believe in a God? Then who tells you what to do? I hope that we aren't ethical only because God tells us what to do. And that's not what Kant said. What Kant said was the following. He said it's a classical cosmological proof. He said, when I use the word ethics, and I assume everybody in the room, if they haven't been receiving over sophisticated philosophy, when they use the word ethics, we mean is that certain things are right, certain things are wrong, and we are obligated, we are chayav, to do that which is right and to avoid that which is wrong. What Kant pointed out is that if that's what you believe in, and that's what all people believe in the beginning, unless people don't have that concept at all, are considered to be sociopaths, and are sent to either prison or to psychological hospitals for the criminally insane. If that's what you believe, then Kant pointed out, then you've already admitted that there exists something. I'm not going to call him God just yet. There exists something which is the cause of something in the world, but isn't caused by anything in the world. In other words, if we change the room, if we paint the walls a different color, if we change the fields, if we change anything in the world, that's not going to change the fact that it's wrong to do A and it's right to do B. That's what ethics means. In other words, ethics isn't merely a solution to our problems. It's not that, in other words, if we were all smarter, then it would be okay to kill people. If we were all taller, if we were better fed, if our economy was failing, would it then be okay? Kant had a very, very strong, I admire, had a very strong, he called the categorical principle of ethics. What's right is right, and what's wrong is wrong, and it doesn't make a difference, exigencies and certain conditions. That means that nothing in the world is a cause of, now the thing I'm talking about is not a person, necessarily, it's not an object, it's a thing. The thing is ethics. Okay, but ethics is a noun, ethics is a thing. Ethics affects the world. It's a cause of how we are supposed to act. It's a cause of our ethical system. But it's not caused. And that, said Kant, that is what I call God. Now, very similar to the cosmological proof of the Rambam, if you then stay there, I think you have a more fleshed out God than merely the first mover, but it's also not necessarily someone to whom you're going to daven. In other words, your God is ethics. Okay, ethics is not necessarily a person. You can be a very ethical individual. You won't go to shul. You won't go to church. You can't even go to shul. And you're missing a lot of things which we call religion. But the point is, you're not a naturalist. Ethics, the good, is a non-natural or
use the same term, is a supernatural quality. Naturalists, which is, as I said, the dominant philosophical theory today, are going to have to, if they're philosophically consistent, they're not always philosophically consistent, but philosophically consistent, they're going to have to address or invent a theory of ethics which will treat ethics as a natural quality, because there are no supernatural qualities. If ethics is a natural quality, then the way we use the word ethics, it doesn't exist. I'm saying that from my point of view. There are whole books explaining what natural ethics consists of, but for instance, it'll be something like, there are a lot of versions, it'll be something along these lines. Ethics is what people believe they should do, and the reason why they believe they should do it is because it solves a certain problem. So for instance, a psychological theory of ethics, a psychological evolutionary theory of ethics. A very long time ago, people were gatherer hunters. The women stayed home and cooked, and the men went out and hunted Tyrannosaurus rexes, or something smaller, I hope, some sort of dinosaurs, and brought them home to be eaten. Now, these dinosaurs are very, very big, and one person against a dinosaur would probably lose. So they realized that the best way to kill a dinosaur was to have cooperation. Now, if you have cooperation, you have to be friends. You have to be nice to people. So over something between 1 million and 2 million years, you got this wiring in your head that said that we'll do better if we're nice to each other. And that's the basis for ethics. This is a theory that you can find on the shelf of any decent library, not the one in this yeshiva, but any other decent library. It's sociobiology version of ethics. It says it's conditioning, because society, basically a particular kind of society, needed. Of course, one of the results of that is that if you don't live in that kind of a society, if you live in a society which is not hunter-gatherers, but say a society that consists of very sharp stock traders, then there's no particular reason to be nice to other people, because then you'll be sharing information with them and the stock won't go up. The only way that you can make money in the stock market is if you know something they don't know. Insider trading. And so that becomes ethical. In other words, what I'm trying to illustrate is that what sociobiological ethics says is that ethics isn't real. It's just a sidur. When I say it's real, it's not something which is in Kant's terms, it's not categorical. You don't have to do it. You think you have to do it. That's a trick in your brain, perhaps. But all it consists of is the way the neurons in your brain are arranged. And the reason why they're arranged that way or this way, it could be chance, it could be for this evolutionary conditioning I just described, it could be something else, it could be brainwashing, it could be that once upon a time, this was a very popular theory once, there were a couple of people, they were called Solon, Moses, different people who thought it would be good, it would be better for society to behave ethically, so they trained people. They basically trained adults to tell the kids when they're very, very young, if you're not nice, you will suffer. Why does the kid believe that's true? No, because the parent hit him when he wasn't. Nobody's going to believe the parents. Who believes their parents? But it was trained. It's a different version of evolutionary theory. It's not evolution of a million years, evolution over 3 years. But when you're very little, if you didn't talk nice, so your father, once upon a time, when I was a child, your father gave you a patch. That's why you guys don't talk nice, because your parents didn't, you know, weren't allowed to hit you anymore. But why did the parents do that? It wasn't comfortable for them to have kids doing bad things in the house, so they trained them, and then you got older, you still believed it. Doesn't make a difference how you do it. The philosophic theory says when you say that something is good, you don't mean anything at all. You mean that it's convenient. You mean that it's good for society. The fullest upshot is a theory by men. Must be a lot of people behind it, but the first article I read that was written in the 1940s, a man named John Stevenson, who was a professor of philosophy in England, he said, when I say something is good, all I mean is, what it really means is, that I like it. Which means that you can't argue about ethics. You're not discussing something that's real. We can argue whether the wall is white or not, because it really is white. But you can't argue about ethics, because when I say that it's wrong to kill, I mean, I don't like killing. And you say it's right to kill, you mean that you like killing. We're not having an argument here. If I like steak and you like a filter fish, we're not arguing about anything. We're simply describing our own personal preferences. Stevenson was a serious person. I assume he was an ethical person. I assume he didn't go out and kill people. But frankly,
he didn't have any basis for not killing people, because there is no injunction, there is no categorical principle that you're not allowed to kill. That's also why the proof, the ethical proof of the existence of God, is not a proof. And Kant realized this 250 years ago. All you have to do is say that it's not true. In other words, motion, maybe we'll agree, exists, although the philosophers will say motion doesn't exist either. But it's very easy to say that. You pay a big price, but it's very easy to say that ethics doesn't really exist. It doesn't describe an actual obligation. If there is an obligation, then God exists. When I say God exists, I don't mean that the creator of the world exists. I don't mean that there's somebody, a person, who is also saying you should do the right thing. All I'm saying is that there's something which we, how do we detect it? How do we detect the ethical thing that is a supernatural quality? Now with our eyes. Motion we describe with our eyes. How do we detect the existence of the supernatural ethical imperative? We call it conscience, right? We detect it with our intellect in some what's called the moral intellect. Kant had a whole division between practical reason, which we call ethics, and metaphysical reason, which we call metaphysics, theoretical ethics. But in some way, the reason could describe things. Now, you realize that when you have an argument about ethics, sometimes you have trouble getting the argument off the ground because the person says, I just don't agree with you. In other words, he sees it differently. If I say the wall is white, how do I know I can see it? You say it's black, I can see it. Then we're going to have trouble arguing. We need another method. We need to get a spectrograph or some method of arguing, because you're colorblind. You know, you just don't agree with me. So some people are colorblind in ethics. But the fact is that 99% of the world's population agree on the basic principles of ethics. There's a whole field today. As I said, most modern academic fields are naturalistic. And one of the things which I mentioned 3 weeks ago, people asked me about it, and I said that sociology is the most dangerous, the most critical, and most undermining field of modern scholarship for religious belief. And so one of the reasons why that's true is what's not actually sociology, it's a relative sociology, anthropology. There was a period of time when anthropologists thought their main job was to run around the world and discover societies that are different ethic than we do, which showed that ethics is relative to society. Now, here's a great example. This is an example, it's an old example. I don't know if people even still use it anymore, but everything I know is old and out of date. So somebody got up to the Aleutian Islands and discovered that Eskimos, when you got to be 62 and a half, Rabbi Ryan, when you got to be 62 and a half, Eskimos celebrated your 62 and a half birthday by putting you in a canoe and pushing you out to sea. Now, we think that's very unethical, but they thought that was ethical. Now, what's the explanation? The explanation was there wasn't enough food in the Aleutian Islands. So they made a choice that it's better to save the food for the young people, and these guys have already had a good life, you know. I mean, they had 62 years, which apparently is a lot. In fact, I think it was more or less 48. I don't believe Eskimos lived to be 62. Anyway, you got to be the age when you weren't contributing to society anymore, and you were just a burden. So we pushed you out to sea. Well, you went out to the great, I'm sure they had a very nice word for it, the great frozen tundra of heavens, and you became a frozen part of the hereafter. Okay. Now, people in Kansas thought that was a terrible thing. That shows that ethics is relative, because now the truth is it shows the opposite. Because why did the Aleutian Islanders push their old people out to sea? They made I can disagree, and they were disagreeing on something very, very petty. The basic ethical principle is the same, that you should maximize life. There's not enough food. And so, oh, it's true. There's a Gemara that says that you cannot choose one life over another. So there's a real ethical argument. You're not allowed to kill somebody in order to save your life. But the basic ethic, you could argue with them why, because there was a shared basic ethic. The shared basic ethic was that you should maximize life. And therefore, now it's a complicated question. Should you maximize the life of young people, healthy people who contribute to society, and therefore they can maximize more lives? They can then also gather food and I don't know, catch frozen fish for more people, whereas therefore more people in the end will live if we kill for few. That's an ethical decision which we understand, because it's based on the same ethics that we have, with a small and very important machloket about the patim. In fact, there is no society in the world which thinks that killing is good, unless it's directed to your enemies. There is no society in the world which kills its friends, which kills its members. Now, I know I already offered you the evolutionary explanation for that. I'm not saying you can't give an explanation, but there is no society in the face of the earth, nor could there be, when you think about the evolutionary argument, that thinks that it's okay to kill your friends,
You're of course allowed to kill your enemies, and frankly we think you're allowed to kill your enemies too. Just depends, the question is how you define your enemies. Some tribes in Africa or in Amazon think that everybody is their enemies. Okay, so that's a question of fact. They've been trained to think that kill first and ask questions later. And we're a little more machmir on that. We think safek nefashos is lechuma. So first you should wait for them to draw their blow tube or their spear and wave it menacingly in your direction, and then there's a machloket between many people that I know and the Israeli government as to whether or not then you have to shoot for the legs or you can shoot straight for the heart. Okay, there are a lot of machlokot here. I'm not saying ethics is a very controversial subject, but the fact is that 99% of the world share the same basic ethic. Now that doesn't prove anything. It could be 90% of the people of the world are wired in the same way, because of evolutionary reasons, because of societal reasons, because of all sorts of reasons. It's an interesting fact that. But truth is, 99% of the people in the world think the wall is white. How many people? Well, 92%. The amount of people, well, white, everybody thinks. Colorblindness is only something like, serious colorblindness is something like 8% of the population. That doesn't prove that colors are true. We all know that colors don't really exist, right? It's true, colors don't really exist. Wavelengths might exist, but colors are just the way your brain processes it. Why is your brain processes it that way? That could be evolution. Okay? So I'm not proving anything. This is what Kant understood. Ethics, you can, there's no problem to get up and say ethics doesn't exist. But we do think that ethics exists, and if we don't think ethics exists, we're going to have certain serious problems in what kind of problems are we going to have? It's a vicious cycle. We're going to have very serious moral problems. Okay? So if you don't care about morality, then you don't have a problem being non-ethical. I'm not saying unethical. Non-ethical. Now, there are serious people today who are serious philosophers, and they hold from naturalism, and therefore they don't believe that ethics is a supernatural meaning, an arbitrary thing, and they're still ethical. I hope. And the reason why they're ethical is because they'll say ethics is convenient if they're serious. Chances are they're ethical because their parents spanked them when they were younger, because they're just used to being ethical. I suspect very strongly that if we had a serious and widespread, which we have, naturalistic philosophy, which affects everything, by the third generation people won't be ethical. I mean, it just sort of wears off. But I'm not saying that atheists are by definition non-ethical, but atheists are by definition non-ethical. They don't hold an ethic which ascribes to their ethic categorical basis, which everybody when they're at the age of 13 to 14 does think. So again, it's not a proof. But what it does do, as the previous proofs I described, is it draws a very clear line between two kinds of people. Theists will believe in a categorical ethic. They have a tendency to believe that the categorical ethic is found in a book written by the person they call God. But that's a very different question. Okay, but theists will believe that there is something which obligates them, meaning affects them, it's a kind of effect, obligation, for which they can't affect. Nothing I will do, for instance, davening, or paying money, is going to change ethic. It's wrong to do the following. Well, maybe if I ask nicely, it'll become mutter. No, it won't become mutter. Maybe if I pay, maybe if I give a large donation to the Democratic Party, it'll be okay. Ethically, we know the answer is no. Factically, we know the answer is yes. But ethically, we know the answer is no. You can't pay to change ethics. That's what the theist or atheist believes. A true and radical atheist, someone who does not believe, someone who has answered the previous proof by saying that the system explains itself, will say that as part of the system, people have certain thoughts in their heads. Where do those thoughts come from? They come from the system. They come from the way your brain is wired. Why is your brain wired that way? Well, that's going to have the same explanation. Your brain is wired the way it's wired for the same reason that the table has four legs. In other words, because certain physical laws, certain laws which are themselves part of the cause of effect, have wired your brain the way they're wired. And I'm sure everyone here, even if you just read pop culture, if you just read the paper, and you've come across arguments both in the field of ethics and in other fields which are basically saying that why do people, I read an article recently, why do people smile? Why does somebody smile at you when you smile at them? I'm not sure that's an ethical response, but it's a response. And the answer is, they'll start going back to the hunter-gatherers or to the, I don't know, somebody, and they'll explain why evolutionary biology explain why smiling is a good thing. Now, I think smiling is a good thing because it's nice, it makes people happy. No,
Smiling is a good thing because it indicates to him that you're not an enemy, and therefore he won't stab you before you stab him, which gives you a certain advantage if you're planning to stab him. I'm not making this up. This I actually meant. Until now I made it all up. This one is real. This is a real article. Smiling apparently is something which has eluded evolutionary biologists for 50 years. They just can't figure out where it comes from. They understand where sharing comes from. They understand where all kinds of things come from. But why do people smile? And why do people smile when other people smile? Or I think it was about laughter. Why, if I tell a joke in Yiddish now, why will you laugh? Now, this I know is true, because I stood in a class in philosophy in Columbia University where the teacher insisted on telling jokes in Yiddish. He was a demigod at the time, Professor Sidney Morgan Besser. Everybody thought he was the smartest person on earth. And therefore, when he told a joke in Yiddish, they all laughed. At which point, he used to look at the two boys with yarmulkes in the class and give them a wink. He thought we understood the joke. And we were laughing too. But we knew why he was winking at us. He was winking, saying, look at these guys, and they laugh at the jokes which they don't understand. We didn't understand it either. But it's a psychological, it's been proven a million times in laboratories. If three people in a room laugh, everybody else laughs also. So they couldn't figure out why. I read, there was an article I read recently explained why it takes place. The same thing is true for ethics. There's, you want another version? The latest version of naturalistic explanation for ethics? Again, it's the way your brain is wired. But the way your brain is wired is a question not of evolutionary biology, but a question of wiring. It's a question of modern neuroscience. It happens to be that it's all an accident. In other words, the brain is wired for other things, but on the way, the wires happen to work in this way, and therefore, brain scientists, people who do MRI imaging, are going to find the place in your brain where ethical thinking takes place, and therefore, what's the next step? You find the drug, which when you give people, they will think in a different ethical manner. Because the way you think ethically is just how your receptors, which chemicals are affecting which receptors in your brain. If we change that, some people are depressed. What do we do when people are depressed? We don't send them anymore to psychologists to talk them out of it, or to rabbis to tell them it's awesome. We give them a pill. We give them Valium. So some people think that, the question which most people are worried about, some people think it's okay to kill. Right? They're sociopaths. You give them a pill and they won't think that way anymore. Of course, the opposite is true too. Some people think it's wrong to kill. You give them a pill, the opposite pill, the anti-pill, and they'll think it's okay to kill. It's just the way your brain is, the way your brain is wired. It's nothing actually true about the ethics itself. It's simply an aspect of the world. Now, since I assume, as I said, why do I say this? I think this is the most important proof for the existence of God. Because it is true, as opposed to the proof I'll give in 3 weeks, which I think is almost, psychologically, you just can't say that the fact on which it's based is not true. You can try, but it's very difficult. This one, the truth is, it's not a good proof to tell people who you think are very much committed to not accepting it. Because then you're going to push them to be not only atheists, but also to be immoral. So it may not be a good idea. It's like, Yimutav Shiyu Shogim Valyu Mezidim. But nonetheless, what this illustrates is what I said in the beginning. The cosmological proof sets up, in principle, a relationship between us and God whereby He affects us and we don't affect Him. There's an aspect of that which has to do with Hashkacha. And we'll talk about Hashkacha much later. In other words, God affects us because He makes it rain, and we don't affect Him because He makes it rain anyhow. Okay, so that is what we were taught when we were young as the most important part of our relationship with God. The proof I just said now emphasizes a different, very important, I suspect more important, relationship to God, namely that God's existence obligates us to act in a certain manner. And I don't necessarily mean, although I do mean, but I don't necessarily mean obey His mitzvahs. What I mean is obey the good. And we're going to talk about in 3 or 4 weeks, no, 4 or 5 weeks, the relationship between the mitzvahs in the Torah and the injunctions of ethics. But there has to be a relationship because we only believe in one God. But if there were two gods, it would be okay. In other words, the point is that the cosmological proof, and this cosmological proof explains really why, how if there is a God, then you're under an obligation to act in a certain manner because His existence changes the world, but the world's existence does not change Him. In this case, does not change what ethics is dictating. Since most people, now I'm saying, why is it also a good proof, as proofs go? Since most people do in their heart of hearts, it's just one of those things about people's brains, have a categorical ethic. They really believe that certain things are really wrong and certain things are really right. They would occasionally like to squirm out of the implications of that, right? We go over Yetzirah. But nonetheless, even most people who do something wrong know they're doing something wrong. That's the legal test of criminal sanity. A person aware of the fact that what he did was wrong. Most people are aware of the fact that it was wrong and nonetheless chose to do it. And the ethical proof of people who are able to understand its implications is in fact a very good proof. You cannot maintain a categorical ethic without admitting that nature is not everything. And therefore that science, for instance, isn't everything, because what we just described now cannot be discovered by science. Science does not have the ability to detect a categorical ethic. It can detect my brain cells. It can detect what will be good for society. But it can't detect why it's wrong, even if it is good for society. Anyone who believes that it's wrong to kill somebody, even though society would benefit by my killing him, because he's mean and old and no one likes him and he has a lot of money, and if we kill him, my Uncle Scrooge, all he does is he buys cats and he tortures them. And if I kill him, I inherit his money, and I promise I will distribute it to a lot of you. And so there are a lot of arguments. Well, but if you kill him, it'll cut you other people. No, I'll kill him secretly. No one will know. I'll use some of the money to buy off the newspapers. But it'll cause psychological problems. I'll use some of the money to pay the psychiatrist, which doesn't cost that much anymore, just two pills. So nothing bad will result from it. If you agree that, no, it's still wrong, then you're a categorical ethicist. And that means that you just said there is a God. Not necessarily the God of the Torah, but you said there is a God in the way I defined the word God last week, 2 weeks ago. God is he who affects the world, he is that, not who. He is that which affects the world, but the world is not affected by him. Yes?
This question might be contradictory on itself, but why does the existence of a right and wrong obligate us to do the right?
Because that's what the word right and wrong mean. In other words, that's why I'm using the word. Again, you can define it differently, which is what philosophers do today. When I say right, I mean advantageous. I mean beneficial. I mean there's a whole... The first theory in this direction, which then is directly addressed in metaphysical underpinnings of it, is called utilitarianism. Utilitarianism is 200 years old. It's John Bentham, and usually associated with the name of John Stuart Mill, who I quoted in the Quran 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, as supporting the theological proof of God. John Stuart Mill was a utilitarianism. He said, ethics is that which brings the most benefit for the most people. What he didn't ask is, why should you do that? But this utilitarianism developed and got wedded with sociology and a little bit of biology, it became, well, naturally people have been trained to do that which gives the most benefit to most people. And true utilitarianism would be that which gives the most benefit for me. But that's sort of unethical. So they had to make it mass utilitarianism. And then the question is, well, why do I feel it necessary to help the most people? It doesn't help me. And so it became, we've been trained that way. So utilitarianism, frankly, is... there's no steer in people's brains. Most people are at the same time categorical ethicists. They really do believe that they have to act this way. But when they apply ethics, they're really utilitarians. You say to them, why is that good? They say, oh, because it makes people feel good. In other words, when you give somebody an ethical principle which doesn't really make people happy, so it makes people, gives them a funny feeling. I'm not going to talk about this today. But it's one of the most famous problems in modern ethics is what's known as it has an official name. So to remember, the train conductor. It has a name. Called the trolley car. Who knows? Is there anybody? Are there people who don't know what a trolley car is? Trolley car is like a train. Okay, so someone's going down the train. There's somebody on the tracks, and there are 10 people behind you. If he moves the train and kills that person, everybody gets saved. Otherwise, they all fall off. And so the assumption, the person who made the question, whose name I forget, there was a woman philosopher in England, I think it was Mary Warnock, was that, of course, you're supposed to kill the person and save the people. And then she went on and had all kinds of paradoxes, but suppose there were two people, suppose it's like this, suppose it's like that. What's the question? Of course, the answer to the halacha is that you don't kill the person. You're not going to kill one person and save 10. But her assumption was that she just assumed everybody would answer that of course you have to maximize the good for the most number of people, and therefore 10 people are worth more than one person. Our natural system of doing ethics is a thing of totalitarianism, but our natural philosophy for why totalitarianism is correct is not utilitarian. We just assume that that's, you know, it's your chayef. That's when I say the word ethics, that's what I mean. In other words, some things are obligatory. Now, obligation is not a natural, is not a natural quality. It is, there's a famous line from, what's his name, G.E. Moore. G.E. Moore said that philosophically you're not allowed to confuse is and ought. Science and naturalism describes what is. What ought to be is not a scientific view. You wouldn't ask a scientist, like, what should be. You could ask him what is, which is the reason why, if I can make a practical comment, you'll find all the time in the newspapers, and even in learned articles, that the if you want to know the answer to, for instance, the question of, the halachic question of organ transplants, so you have to ask a doctor. Because doctors know when people die. Of course, doctors don't know when people die, because the question of a person dies isn't really a is question, it's an ought question. The question is, what is the value of somebody who is in a non-reversible coma? And value questions cannot be scientific questions. They describe what should we do, not what is. We know what is. The person is, he has a heartbeat and he has no brain function, or that the scientist could tell us. But what is the ought status, what is the ethical status of that? There's no reason why scientists should be able to know that question. Scientists like the claim that they know the answer to that question because scientists are naturally naturalists. They think there is no other question. And therefore, they'll simply define what they mean. That's a classic example of mixing up is and ought. So when I say ethics, now, modern philosophy, many modern philosophers say there is no ought. People talk, they use the word, but they don't mean it. They don't realize they don't mean it. When I say you ought to do the following, I mean I would like you to do the following. Or it would be beneficial if you do the following. Now the word good, for instance, just pointing out a little bit in semantics, the word good does mean that sometimes. What do I mean when I say it's a good screwdriver? I mean it gets the job done. What do I say that you're a good person? Do I mean you get the job done? Or do I mean that, no, you're an ethical person. In all languages that I know of, going back to ancient Greek, it was the same word. And the confusion between good as being meets the standard, the practical standard, and meets the ethical standard, there's a tendency to confuse the two. A natural tendency. It could be there's a good reason why it's the same word. But nonetheless, we do distinguish between the two meanings. It could be that it's not a good thing to behave ethically, meaning it's not beneficial, it makes everybody very, very unhappy. You know, I refuse to act unethically, and therefore everyone hates me. And I may even hate myself. So it's very bad for my mental health to act ethically. And the Rav used to go on for hours about how modern, meaning 1950s, 1960s, maybe even today, religion in America was being sold as being good for you. If you accept God, if you accept Jesus as your Savior, you will be a happier person, have a better home life. And the Rav was really convinced that if you're a religious person, it might be bad for you. It would probably be bad for you. It would be tormenting. I mean, anyone who's read the Long Night of Faith knows that the Rav almost thought the opposite. The more you believe in God, the more you accept God, chances are that you'll have a terrible life. Because you'll be obligated to do things which are really uncomfortable. It's not good for you, but it's good. So that's what I meant when I said the word good. I meant in that sense, which we do tend to think is true. I haven't proven it's true. I'm taking a phenomenon which exists and saying that if this phenomenon really exists, then there must be something behind it. There must be something which not commands it, but is the source of the obligation. And that source of obligation, it has this unusual relationship. It's a cause, but it's not an effect. Nothing in the natural world can be a cause and not an effect. If fire causes A, then B will put the fire out. Everything is in this chain. But ethics is not within the chain, it's outside the chain, but affects the chain. Yes?
Couldn't you argue that the original cause had its effect on the universe and set the world in motion, but then it didn't continue to have any relationship?
Sure, of course you could. Of course you could.
And you're not dependent on the world, and you're not obligated to do anything to obey it.
You're right. Who said anything about obeying? I said there's a... you're right. You're 100% right. And that which we call Torah and Mitzvot has not been proven, nor will it be proven today, nor tomorrow, nor in the foreseeable future.
It will only be proven when you meet a Kadosh Baruch Hu, when you realize that it's true. All the Rambam tried to do, was to show that what I said I'm trying to do, that there exists a non-natural, a supernatural entity, and that is what we call God. Everything else you want to say about God has to be hung on that. What I'm saying is that it makes a difference what you're hanging your conception of God on. Let me just go back 1 week and explain what I mean. If you had started with the theological proof from 3 weeks ago, I need an explanation for why the world appears to be with purpose, organized, and therefore God is the great organizer. Now, what can I hang on that? You're absolutely right. It's much easier, even though you could still argue that he hasn't had much to do in the last 6,000 years, but it's much easier to hang on that conception, the feelings of praise, of admiration, perhaps of prayer, etc., etc., which is why it's a very convenient kind of God. Of course, at the same time that the theological proof was prevalent in England in the 6th and 17th century, deism was the intellectual's version of religion. Deism says, there's a God, he created the world, and he's been on extended vacation ever since. So when we pray to him, what do? We don't ask him for things. He's on extended vacation. It's not nice. What we do is we praise him. It's right. It's ethical. It's proper to praise he who 6,000 or 10,000 years ago arranged the world in such a beautiful manner. Deism was a very convenient way of meeting the requirements of the Church of England without actually having to do anything. You had a religious sentiment. It's 100% logical. But you have to admit that it exists. Now, ethics, the ethical proof I mentioned today, is different than, that's why I think it's a more significant proof than the Rambam's proof. Because the Rambam's proof leads us with a God who is the first cause of motion. Very interesting. The world would be very different if he did not exist, and I'm thankful for that. But, you know, not much more. The ethical proof of God is something which affects me on a daily basis. I'm in communication with God every time I have to make a choice. That's an ethical choice. And God, meaning, again, not the God who created the world, not the God who spoke to Moshe Rabbeinu, not the God who told us about Sitzes, but the ethics, right? The obligation to be good is something which I'm in constant communication with, and I am dependent on it in that field. I'm not dependent on, I don't need it in order to get wheat to grow out of the earth. That's a different God. But if I obey ethics, or if I disobey ethics, I'm being affected. I'm in communication with God in a very, very important area. Frankly, I'm saying something which is half kfira. Frankly, if you had to choose, no, I don't want to say that. There are basically two gods in our experience as from people. There's the God who creates the world, brings down the rain, does things. When you do A, he doesn't like it. Forget about ethical or not. If he's angry, should we break Sharam? If he likes you, he gives you money. The God of action. And then there's the God of ethics. At some point, I'm going to give a session. I'm going to say that the real meaning of Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad is that those two have to be one. But which is a difficult thing to put together because there's no connection between them. If you had to choose to believe in a God who runs the world but is not ethical, is not one with ethics, or a God who is one with ethics but doesn't actually run the world, which you shouldn't have to choose between because they're both true, but if you had to choose, personally, I'd rather you choose the ethical one. Because unethical, powerful gods are demonic. That's what Avodah Zarah had. Zeus is a very powerful, not totally powerful, but a very powerful and totally unethical god. And that's really bad. By definition, it's bad. It's unethical. And it's better to have an unethical religion is the opposite of religion. But that's just my personal opinion. I mean, I think most Jews probably don't agree because most Jews have unethical gods, as we'll see. So that's what I meant when I said that this is a very, very important version of the ontological of the cosmological proof, because it explains a relation between a uncaused causer in a manner which really does affect our lives on a very, very daily basis. Again, I'm not saying that because the proof is true, therefore you should be ethical. I'm saying since you're ethical, you should see the proof is true. But what the proof has shown us is, what does it mean to believe in God, or this kind of God? It means that there's something which is, you know, which affects me, and I'm obligated to it. I'm obligated because that's the meaning of the word ethical, and my life is shaped to a great extent by it. It's an important area of my life, the ethical area of my life.
And that's the relationship between me and God. I worship now, I as a from Jew, I worship God, if I continue the proof, I worship God because He is the source of, that tells me how to act it, that teaches me the difference between right and wrong. And that which is the source of teaching between right and wrong is something which I have a very particular relationship with, a religious relationship with, which is very important in my life. There'll be other things which I'll add, but that's a very, very crucial step in which to begin. Someone who denies that, what I'm really interested in is the opposite. Someone who denies it, what is he left with? He's left with a world that has no value, that has no truth. There's nothing wrong with using these words. It has no meaning in the sense of the word meaning. Brave atheists say, yeah, that's what the world does. What does that mean? It just has facts. There's no meaning to atoms. There's no meaning to neurons. There's no meaning to chemicals. That's it. The world has no meaning. Okay, say that. That's the divide that this particular proof puts between the two sides. I mentioned before the line, the end of Ne'ilah, where we say, "Ki im echta ma'yolah." What do we do? How does that affect God? There's a great line in certain kind of Jewish philosophy that says it makes a big difference to God. But on the philosophical basis, you have to stop from this point. That's what the tefillah is saying. The saying is, listen, we don't do things because we're doing God favors. We feel bad on Yom Kippur because we realize that God is doing us a favor. We're not doing Him favors; He's doing us a favor, and therefore our in the beginning of Yom Kippur also. In other words, by acting immorally or against Mitzvot Hashem, another version, same thing. Acting immorally is bad for you. What does it mean bad for you? Not that you'll suffer. It's bad for you because it's bad, but it doesn't affect he who said to act that way. Because he was saying the truth, and the truth remains the same, no matter what. That's if you can adopt, if you can absorb the feeling that goes beyond that, that lies behind that. I think you understand Yom Kippur a lot better. In other words, it's not that when I've upset my friend, he's angry at me, and I'm angry at him, and then we make up. Okay, that's within a system. What Tefillat Zaka is saying, and what Ne'ilah is saying, and what Yom Kippur is really about, is that it's not between two people who are bound together. The binding between us and God is, in fact, yes, it's very, very one-sided. And we realize that we're bad. Very simple word. In other words, there's a ethical and religious obligation which hasn't been met, and it doesn't make a difference to God Himself, except that He wants it. It doesn't make a difference to His being, because the ethics cannot change and the truth doesn't change because of what you do or what you don't do. But you are out of whack with the truth. You are out of whack with emes. You are out of whack with ethics. You are out of whack with good. And Yom Kippur comes to fix that. It comes to fix ourselves. And by therefore, and as a result, comes to fix our relationship with God. Okay, so that's, I'm not sure how much that was obvious to anybody here, the connection between the philosophical proofs of God and whether or not you should do tshuva, but it's in the end, it's based on it. If there is no non-natural subject, there's no point in doing tshuva because what you are is what you are. And again, I'd just like you to realize how much in modern society, in modern philosophy, modern ideology is comes back to a feeling that whatever is, and if it is, it's okay. In other words, basically, science describes, and therefore, we have to simply know what there is and use it. It's very ingrained in 20th century, and therefore by necessity in 21st century, ideology, academia, talking about things which cannot be described is beyond the pale. You can't do it anymore. So we only describe what is. The ethical implication of that is that there is no ethics. Just what is. This person is like this. This person is like that. It could be it's our interest to get rid of them. They're messing up our society, but you can't really condemn them. They just have their brains are screwed on in a different manner. Occasionally it takes very, very extreme versions. Aldi Lane, who died 2 years ago, used to be a psychiatrist, and then he became a purveyor of LSD. And among other things, he claimed, who says psychosis is bad? You know, who says that the criminally insane are criminally insane? Just the way they think. And he proved it by taking LSD himself and seeing things differently. You know, so whatever is. And it was enjoyable, and that he went into business, and he's quite famous. He wrote a number of books, and when he died, they celebrated his death by having a giant LSD thing in San Francisco. But he was an important psychiatrist in the 21st century. Whatever is, and what isn't, isn't. And we don't talk about things like is and ought, because is and ought are not natural qualities. You cannot, in a modern university in the United States today, I don't think you can raise the existence of non-natural qualities at all, even though everybody in the room believes in, and couldn't confess it, really does believe in ethics. But you can't talk about it, because the discourse is only naturalistic. And if you only have a naturalistic discourse, then of course there's no God. Aside from being no God, there's also no ethics. And as we'll see in 3 weeks, there's also no reason, which is going to be something which is a little bit difficult to swallow. There can't be anything other than atoms moving around and bouncing into each other, which is what science says. That's what science investigates. And an increasing number of people think that that's how they're going to explain everything else, by simply measuring atoms where they're going and showing how they crash into one another. Yeah?
Would the Rosh say that the, when it says, Vayar Elohim Ki Tov, is that a practical good or is that an ethical good when she's describing the universe? And that it conforms to the purpose of a Sanaf, more like a good scripture, or that it's.
The obvious explanation is what you hinted at. It means that it works. God said, oh, everything will be fine. But the Amid Rashi, which explained that God said this, which comes to say that, and then you have to explain that. That means it comes to a discourse then, why it's good that things should exist. Beit Shammai said, given the way the world is, why did God think it was a good thing? So that's why the Pasha Pshat definitely includes the fact that God said, it's going to work. You know, there'll be enough food to support the population in the next 6,000 years. Chazal understood it to mean be an ethical, metaphysical standard as well. But that requires explanation. Yeah?
When the Torah describes God having emotions, doesn't that imply that God is affected in some way, even if it's in a way that you can't understand?
Yes, it does.
So how do we
reconcile? So either you wipe that out, like the Rama did, right, say it doesn't say that, or you have some other theory. I'll have to give it to you now. Yes, in other words, it's important that you first realize, before you accept any other theory, first realize why you're right. That will say, b'chozot yesh mashu nasa. But yes, the Pasha Pshat in the Middle Ages was, of course, God doesn't have emotions. It's a little bit unfair. The Rambam and all the people in the Middle Ages thought that emotions were bodily characteristics. It was caused by the humors that flow through your body. If you have an excess of blood, you're angry. If you have an excess of lymph fluids, then you're depressed. So of course God is not emotions. But even if it wasn't that, there's a problem of causation. But then you have to have maybe a theory of emotions. You're assuming that anger is something which is caused by incitement. Obviously, Lam didn't think that. Lam thought that you should decide to be angry as my response to things which I don't like. They're not caused by the things, they're ethical responses. So perhaps when God gets sad, it's an ethical response to saying that things aren't what he likes. So write that down on the list. Someplace in February, we will perhaps answer the question whether or not God has emotions and what kind of emotions. Personally, I think God has emotions, but the Rambam thought he didn't. So it's definitely it's a good question. Don't have to answer. Next.
What did you mean by what you said in the beginning of what you were saying?
In other words, if you understood what I said, I'm not saying that if God doesn't command do not kill, then why shouldn't you kill? Any ethical person knows that you shouldn't kill, even though God doesn't command you shall not kill. The first person who tripped up on that point is called Cain, who God did not tell not to kill, but he wasn't supposed to kill. Killing is wrong whether or not God says you should kill or you shouldn't kill. Now, that creates a certain religious paradox, which we will talk about. How could that be then? then you have two gods. I just said I have two gods. There's the God who talks, and there's the God, and there's the thing I called God today, which is the ethics itself. So we'll talk about that. But the point is, the ethical proof of God is not what you tell people in the street. All atheists are unethical. Atheists are not unethical, because atheists, generally speaking, are people who don't believe in a personal God. They don't believe in a creator God. They don't believe in a God who talks. They don't believe in the God of the Bible. But they do believe in ethics, which is why they're ethical.
But their ethics are subjective.
No. The average atheist, the person who says I'm an atheist, his ethics is not subjective. He is not really an atheist. He believes in the God of ethics, but not in the God who wrote the Old Testament or the New Testament or the Quran or anything else. He doesn't believe there's a God who's a person who talks and does things. But when we speak of ethics, it's a little bit impersonal. There's this weight that says do this and do that. It's not saying it as a voice. So the argument that says that if God doesn't make up ethics, who could have made it up? It's sort of based on the idea if someone doesn't say you shouldn't double park, then why can't you double park? That's true, right? There's nothing wrong with double parking unless the government said you shouldn't double park. So therefore, a person, sometimes you hear this argument, and I think it's a profoundly immoral argument. If God didn't like the government, if he didn't say do not kill, then why shouldn't you kill? And the answer that the person that's being addressed to says, because it's wrong to kill. What's wrong with you? And he's like, it's a very good answer. Religious people who say that if God hadn't said do not kill, it would be okay to kill, are immoral. They're Cain. That's what Cain said. What's wrong? Actually, he didn't say that. But he could have said that. Why is it us or you didn't say it's us? And the answer is the Torah believes that. We'll talk about this. This is a very important topic. We'll talk about it in the near future. It's wrong to kill whether God said it or not. And why? Because it's wrong. That it is wrong is what today I call God. Okay, so I'm using the word God here in two different senses. So, but what I say is, I'm not trying to say is that if you don't think God wrote the Torah, then why is it also to kill? It's also to kill if God hadn't written the Torah. It's also for Bantus in Africa to kill, even though they had no hitkadut at all. No one told them it's also to kill. Because they don't have Islam, they don't have Christianity, they don't have Jews, they don't have anything. But it's wrong to kill. You know it's kill. Avraham Avinu said to God, it's wrong for you to kill. Which is the real nafkamina. If God is the legislator, then he can also give himself excuses. But if Avraham Avinu told God, he's not allowed to kill the people in stone. Because it's wrong. Because it's really wrong. That's what I mean. The really wrong is what we call ethics. And that itself is you don't use the word God, that itself is a supernatural quality. Okay? The supernatural exists. There's something which affects us, which we do not affect. And we call that ethics. That's very different than the argument which is, I think, a terrible argument that says, but if God didn't say it's wrong, then why don't you do it? That's saying, if no one's watching you, then why do you obey the law? When no one's watching me, I do double park. But I usually don't steal. The reason is because it's okay to double park, but it's wrong. But it's wrong to steal. It's a kind of God, right? It's a different meaning to the word God. I and you think that all the gods are one. So then we're going to put it all together. We will put it all together. Mitzvah Hashem, a couple of weeks. But the proof is not describing everything you mean by the word God. It's describing one particular thing, which we mean by God. I just want to point out that the opposite is true. Many people, maybe even some people in the room. I'm sure when I present this argument, I'm going to get an argument from some of you. Many people here don't really think that the ethical is God. They really think that God can do anything he wants. And if God one day will change his mind and say, kill, then we'll kill. That's the opposite of what I said today. Okay? In other words, I said the ethical is God. Now it's true, God is also he who speaks, so I have to say therefore God is one. And we'll talk about that. But I suspect that most Jews today, many religious people don't think that ethics is ethics. There was an article once that, I always come back to this, there was an article that appeared in a journal, which is a book, which is vaguely connected to the yeshiva, meaning we weren't responsible for the content of the articles. But it was a book that was put out in Zecher of a boy who was killed in Mechemet Lebanon, the first, 1983. And you learned this yeshiva, so that's our connection to the article. But one of the articles is written by someone who has no connection to the yeshiva. He's a famous rabbi in Israel. He's a Rosh Yeshiva and a rabbi, and he's very well known. And he wrote an article which said that there is no such thing as ethics in Judaism. And the word what was his proof? The word musar, which is the way in Hebrew you say ethics, the word musar in the Tanakh doesn't mean ethics, it means, what does it mean? It means torture. You know, it means to afflict. Et asher yes, et asher yohav Hashem, yaser. Musar avicha, is that the ethics of your father? Al titosh musar avicha is what your father yelled at you and said. Yeah, there's that. That's Musa. It's a terrible argument. There. So obviously, it's an unbelievable thing. He's a very famous person. He has a lot of Talmidim. Well, he has a few Talmidim, and he has a lot of Baal Avatim. He has a big shul and a small yeshiva. Thank God. I'm going to figure the article immediately to you. It's a shocking article. So the argument today was the exact opposite. Beintayim, till we get to the next proof. I'm willing to give up on, and even Pater, I'm willing to renege on a God who speaks, and a God who creates, and a God who makes way. The first thing I showed was that there exists something. You don't want to call him God, call it ethics. Atheists don't call that God, they just call it ethics. But they're ethical atheists. They're not natural atheists. Naturalism says that nothing exists other than the system which is described by cause and effect, the system which is described by the natural sciences, in all of its glory, and nothing else can exist. If nothing else can exist, then there can't be any ethics at all. That's all I was trying to show. Yeah?
How do we discover the ethics?
So as I pointed out, it's not a proof, as I said 3 weeks ago, there are no proofs that prove the existence of God in the Euclidean sense. Since today we don't think that Euclidean geometry can be proven in the Euclidean sense, it's such a terrible thing. But in other words, you can always say, I just don't agree with the facts. Right? The cosmological proofs in, as a family, seek to find not a fact, like if it was a theological proof, took a particular fact. Like heaven or earth, say it on that. Cosmological proof seeks to find general criteria which prove the existence of God. But even general criteria can be denied. And therefore, frankly, it is in fact easier to deny the existence of ethics than to deny the existence of emotion. You'd have to it's not that obvious. You have to really straighten yourself. I didn't suggest that we deny the existence of emotion. It's very easy to deny the existence of ethics. It's even advantageous. It's a great thing. That's why I warned you. Don't use this argument to people who you don't think are going to accept it. You're just going to drive them to being unethical. It's easy. That's why I'm not proving anything. Yeah. But it's a fact that most of us think there is ethics. So I'm just saying that if you want to be consistent, if you want to maintain, the only reason why you should want to maintain your ethics. Think about this. What is the reason why a person should want to maintain a categorical ethic? Because it's the right thing to do. I am being circular? Of course I'm being circular. Why is it a good thing to have values? You meet somebody who has no values, doesn't care about anything. So, you know, you should make something, I'm talking about like your high school guidance counselor. You should make something with your life. I want to be a schnook. But you know, you're so talented, you could be a great basketball player. It's too much trouble. You know, what's wrong with that? He has no values. But what's the value in having values? Having values is a value. If you just deny, you just deny. There's no problem, and it makes life much simpler. Okay, so the only reason why a person should want to have an ethic is because he's ethical. Okay, now if you ask me, but how do we know it? The answer is we just know it. It's in our heads. We see it. How do you know the wall is white? Because you can see it. So how do you know that 1 and 1 is 2? Because you can see it with your intellect. How do you know that it's worth to kill? You can see it with your intellect. It's a logical truth, and you can't prove the truth of theoretical logic. You can't prove that something can't be true and not true at the same time. You can't prove that 1 and 1 is 2. And you can't prove that something is that it's worth to kill. It's a truth of logic, of what's called practical logic. We simply see it. Now, that's why it's so invidious, it's so undermining. If I give you a plausible theory to explain why you think that way. And the plausible theory is that if you don't think that way, and the world's going to get messed up. And therefore, by natural selection and brain conditioning, etc., 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 we can show how, you know, the North Koreans can brainwash you and think that it's okay to kill. And everyone read, do people still read futuristic books that took place 30 years ago? Yes. Still read 1984? So what's the whole point of 1984? That with the right methods, you can see that 1 and 1 is 3. And therefore, you begin to wonder, then, how do we know that 1 and 1 is 2? Maybe it's just, you know, we just haven't had, we had different methods applied to us when we were younger that didn't, they weren't as dramatic as being tortured with rats 1 inch from your face, but they basically did the same thing. That's what modern psychology does. It shows you that the reason why you think the 101 is 2 is because it helps you build bridges. If you look, 101 is 3, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that you'd have trouble getting over the bridge because it would fall down. So it just works better, etc. etc. That's why you think it's wrong to kill, because if you thought it was okay to kill, everybody thought it was okay. If our brains were conditioned to think that it was okay to kill, we'd all be dead. It's a great theory. It really works. There's no proof here. But it's an immoral theory. That's not bad. What is bad? That's bad. It's not bad in the other sense. It's not non-beneficial. But it's bad. There's a vicious cycle, I agree. Only if you're ethical do you care about being ethical. If you care about being ethical, then I think you have to be a theist. You have to believe in some sort of a God. Otherwise, you're believing in nothing. You're believing in that. I believe that the way my brain is arranged is the truth. Why? It's just the way your brain is arranged. And computers have helped us. They haven't helped us. They have helped make it worse. Computers have helped us realize why you can't prove anything. Because I can make a computer. I'm the God of the computer. I can arrange the computer. The computer thinks that 1 and 1 is 3. I can easily make a computer which is unethical. When you ask the computer, is it right to kill? The computer says yes. What's the problem? You just have to program it, right? So we're just programmed to think otherwise. But who programmed us? So I'm not saying that God programmed us. I'm saying is, no, nothing programmed us. We see the truth. The evolutionary psychologist says you were programmed by evolution, by society, by your mother, by your father, by the neighbors, by the priests, by the people in power. Why do you all want to get a better car? Why do you all want to get better cell phones? Till 2 months, come on. You don't need anything on that cell phone. Till 2 months ago, everyone in this room had a better cell phone than I did. Today I have a better cell phone than you do, but I fell in. Okay. Why do you all want to get better cell phones? You're being programmed by television, by the advertising industry. It's not really better. We all know you don't really need all that stuff that doesn't do anything. You just want to spend more money that way, right? Why do the Americans in yeshiva go eat and buy breakfast in the Macola? What's wrong with leaven and old bread? People lived on that stuff for years. You've been programmed by the guys who work for General Mills. It's a good theory, you know? What's the name of the book? Oh, it's such an old book that you probably never read. It must be modern books. What's the name of the Hidden Persuaders? The book in the 1970s that first discovered how the advertising industry works, you know? And afterwards, we still bought the stuff, but we felt bad. So right now, when you go to like, why is there music? Why is there music in supermarkets? They prove that it makes people buy more. Why were those candies by the cashier? Because you're waiting in line, and you're bored. So you begin to get hungry, and then you start buying candies. All kinds of these little tricks. So, you know, so ethics is the same thing. It makes sense. It does make sense. I can prove it. I can prove it works. I can prove that the right drug will make you think differently. That doesn't disprove that. In the meantime, it's still true. The right drug, I'll think differently. When you're drunk, you think a lot of things are drunk. So do it. Okay, that's it. Okay, that's it for today.
Thank you very much.
Machati matura. Do tshuva. In the meantime, for the next year.
I assume this has a
shut up, he's going to hear us.
You make a computer that went all time natural thing. The computer says yes. So the computer says no.
Most people.